Turn on the radio in your invisible jet, if you can find it, to listen to Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. I'm Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who will be compelled to tell the truth during this episode.
Mike DiCriccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. It always brings me great pleasure when you giggle at your opening joke, but I'm laughing, but I don't make a noise, so no one knows that I'm laughing.
It sounds, when I laugh, it sounds like you're the one who's laughing, is what it is, I assume.
Sure.
That was very honest of you, Mike. You are compelled to tell the truth during this episode.
It worked.
As opposed to every other episode where every word out of your mouth is a bald-faced lie.
Flat-out lie.
If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we will move on to our featured review, and this week, it is the newest film from director Patty Jenkins and the fourth film in the DC Extended Universe, Wonder Woman. Are you excited to talk about Wonder Woman, Mike?
I am, yeah. I think we're going to have a lot to say.
Yeah, maybe. I think so, too. There's a lot to unpack with Wonder Woman. This thing has been kind of a cultural phenomenon at this point. There's been so much buzz about it online and stuff like that, so really eager to dive into Wonder Woman with you. But before we do that, Mike, we should get into some film news.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for... It's time for...
Film news!
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for... It's time for...
Film news!
All right, so we've got some film news here on Film Bookcast, and arguably the biggest piece of news. This is huge, Mike. Terry Gilliam, the film director, former Monty Python member, I guess former and current. Once you're Monty Python, you're never out of the Pythons,
yeah.
Right? It's like being in a gang. Like it's,
once you're a jet, you're a jet.
But it's a very silly gang.
Hell's Grannies, right?
Yeah, Hell's
Grannies Angels? I can't even remember.
yeah, Terry Gilliam, former slash current Monty Python member, great film director, director of films such as Brazil, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, has actually finished filming The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. If you don't know about this whole thing, this has been a cursed production for like 20 years now.
Yeah, something insane.
Yeah, so I'm like, are you familiar with the all the stuff that's happened in regards to this movie, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote?
I wasn't aware of it until the announcement came out that he was finished with it, and then I read the history about what everything that has happened to this movie.
Okay, well, years ago, I saw a movie called Lost in La Mancha, which is a 2002 documentary, which was about the making of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. And they were filming it with the intention to put it out as like a special feature on the DVD, but since the movie was never released, that never happened, and they ended up releasing this documentary about this cursed production of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
From 15 years ago.
This documentary is from 2002. And it's a really fascinating documentary of like a filmmaker gone mad almost. It's really insane. Some of the stuff that's happened in this movie, pre-production started in 1998. Millions of dollars were spent on this movie. The set was destroyed by a flood at one point. That happened. One of the lead actors got incredibly sick and had to drop out. People like Johnny Depp, Robert Duvall, Ewan McGregor, John Hurt, they were all involved in this at some point, and they all ended up leaving the project. And now, Terry Gilliam has finally made this movie, almost 20 years later, with Jonathan Pryce, who was the star of his movie Brazil and was at the High Sparrow on Game of Thrones, Adam Driver, Olga Kurylenko, and Stellan Skarsgård. And unless the film burns up in a fire or something, which fingers crossed doesn't happen, we should finally one day see it. And that's insane. I never thought this would happen, Mike.
Yeah, of course, there's only one copy of it, and it's on film, and it's going to be lit on fire.
I mean, I would not be surprised if that was the case. Like, if it was transported in some kind of... if it was transported inside a flamethrower for safekeeping, just in case, and somebody accidentally filled up the flamethrower with gas and lit it, that would not shock me.
In a tragic, unforeseeable turn of events.
Yeah, because after like all the filming had to halt and stuff, they were actually filming the movie. Johnny Depp was in it and everything, and like they had to stop it. And then like he was starting to pick it up again, like in like 2005. But there were so many legal battles that like he couldn't even get to the filming stage. And there's so much stuff has happened with this movie, Mike. It's kind of incredible. And Terry Gilliam has made movies, you know, in that interim. He's taken some time off from Don Quixote and done The Brothers Grimm, and he's done Imaginarium with Dr. Parnassus. Most recently, he did The Zero Theorem with Christoph Waltz. So I am pretty stoked about this. I don't know how the movie will turn out. I hope it's great, but we'll see what happens. I am eager. But what's also kind of fascinating to me about this is this kind of like parallels the arc of Don Quixote, right? Isn't that like a character who
it's bizarre. It's kind of weird.
Becomes too ambitious and things turn out tragically for him. That's like a Don Quixote to a T. It's the weird making of the movie that parallels the movie itself, which is pretty insane. Pretty excited about that news, Mike. And then I did have some other really interesting news to talk about. A couple of weeks ago on Amazon, not Prime, just Amazon regular, Amazon.
That's great.
Something very curious happened, Mike. A version of Spider-Man 3 called Spider-Man 3 Editor's Cut was uploaded to Amazon, and then about 2 hours later was taken down. And it seems like this was a mistake. Apparently, this is some kind of reworked cut of Spider-Man 3, which came out 10 years ago. And I am quite intrigued by this, Mike.
Was it a DVD up for sale, or was it like a streaming cut?
It was a streaming cut. So it went on Amazon, and it was available to rent. And people actually rented it in that two-hour span. So people have seen Spider-Man 3, the editor's cut.
I thought it was a listing for this movie. I didn't realize it was like an actual.
Oh no! Somebody accidentally put it on Amazon, and it was available to purchase or to rent. And people did so, and then 2 hours later, it was taken down.
That's amazing.
And I think what it is, I guess, there's a new Blu-ray edition, like a Blu-ray box set of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies that's coming out for the 10th anniversary. Or I guess it wouldn't be the 10th anniversary. It would be the 10th anniversary of Spider-Man 3, but that would be an odd Blu-ray anniversary to celebrate.
Why not?
But I guess there's a new Blu-ray box set of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies, and this was going to be a bonus feature on the Spider-Man 3 Blu-rays, this reworked cut of Spider-Man 3. Apparently, Sam Raimi and his team actually went back and, like, reworked some things in the movie. Sam Raimi is famously not very happy with Spider-Man 3, and so are almost everybody who watches it. I don't happen to be one of those people, by the way. I actually really enjoy Spider-Man 3. I think it's a lot of fun, if not quite as good as Spider-Man 1 or 2. I mean, Spider-Man 2 is a masterpiece of the form. It's
correct.
It's why movies were made. It was to get to Spider-Man 2, and then everything after that is just, an ellipses. It's
And on the seventh day, we made Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, it went the Great Train Robbery, Citizen Kane, Spider-Man 2,
and that's it.
And then nothing. There was nothing after that. That's all the three most important movies ever made.
Hot takes.
Yeah, but I'm very intrigued by a Spider-Man 3 editor's cut, even though I do like Spider-Man 3. Now, how are you? I feel like we watched Spider-Man 3 at some point together, and you came away from it kind of like enjoying it. Like, I feel like I forced you to watch it, but like.
Yeah. I mean, forced is a strong word, but we definitely did watch it together. And I think I remember coming away more on your side of the fence in that it's just a silly, campy, ridiculous Sam Raimi movie that is about Spider-Man. But it's just not as good or silly or as ridiculous as the other ones, like you said.
I think it is as ridiculous.
That's fair. But I think it's interesting that it's the editor's cut. I don't think I've ever heard that before, that kind of phrasing for a recut of a movie.
Yeah. So I don't think it's like a pure director's cut of the movie. I think Sam Raimi was involved in some capacity in any case.
Just living in our postmodern world, that this is the best free marketing and hype you could make for a thing. We quote unquote accidentally put it up on Amazon by accident when we weren't supposed to.
That's true.
I think this is great. I think this is a really cool way for people to get hyped about this.
Yeah, that's true. And so I guess there isn't like too much that's changed in this, but there are some kind of significant things. It is shorter than the actual movie, for one. It's actually shorter than the original version.
Just cut out all the Venom stuff? It's just not about Venom at all.
I don't think that's possible. But they do cut out, like, the cutout. I was reading a description of it from some people who did rent this thing for the 2 hours that it was up. And it cuts out the scene where Aunt May gives Peter back his engagement ring. It cuts out the scene where Peter is apologizing to his landlord while trying to call MJ. It cuts out one of Willem Dafoe's great bits where he's yelling from beyond the grave. and it adds other stuff too, though. It doesn't just cut things. It adds like a lot of shots from trailers that didn't end up in the movie of like Peter wearing the symbiote in broad daylight. It has a full restoration of the score for the movie, and a lot of scenes have new music attached to it.
Oh, that's pretty cool,
which is interesting. So I guess there's a lot more smaller stuff that like people could probably didn't even think about in the 2 hour span that they had the movie available to them. So I am interested for sure.
Yeah.
And it's been a couple years since I've seen Spider-Man 3 at this point. So I would be down for a rewatch, a comparative rewatch. I would watch Spider-Man 3 and then I would watch the editor's cut and then write down all the differences in a little notebook. So I know them
for safekeeping
for myself and no one else. Spider-Man 3 editor's cut, very intriguing stuff. And hopefully, I mean, I like mostly what I want is new Sam Raimi stuff. Like it's cool.
Yeah.
It's cool that he is involved in like kind of reworking one of his older, lesser acclaimed movies. But I really just want a new Sam Raimi movie. It's been too long, man. You know,
I agree.
It's been Oz the Great and Powerful was 4 years ago.
And that left a lot to be desired, I think.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind an editor's cut of that movie, actually. that movie wasn't bad. It was fine.
Yeah.
It was fine. It's actually, I mean, have you seen Oz the Great and Powerful?
Yeah, I feel like, did we do an episode? Like, we couldn't have possibly done an episode on that.
That was before we started this podcast. But what's great about Oz the Great and Powerful is that it is essentially a family-friendly, big-budget remake of Army of Darkness.
Right.
And the similarities are actually insane. Like you can find, I think Matt Singer wrote an article about it when the movie came out. And there's like a list of like 20 to 30 things that are like exactly the same between Army of Darkness and Oz the Great and Powerful. And it's pretty great. But yeah, so Spider-Man 3 editor's cut, very intriguing stuff. Hopefully new Sam Raimi stuff in the future. The last thing I saw him direct was the pilot of Ash vs. Evil Dead.
Right.
And that was great. I love that pilot. And, you know, but it's not a full movie, you know, it's just like a little dose, a little dose of the Raim.
You can't just make up a nickname.
I mean, I can try.
You try.
But yeah, so that's Spider-Man 3 editor's cut. And then I did want to talk about some bummer news, which I feel like we've been ending on bummer news for a while. But Netflix canceled a few of their biggest shows. And this is kind of big because we've talked about this in the past. Netflix has been burning money, like literally.
If that the scene in The Dark Knight when when the Joker lights the giant pile of money on fire.
If they could film money burning, they would do it.
A Netflix original,
and that would be a Netflix original movie. Yeah, it was. Netflix has canceled two of their biggest and most expensive shows, The Get Down and Sense8. And when I say they're the most expensive shows, they're also probably among the least watched shows that Netflix has. And we don't know that for sure because Netflix has not released their numbers, so that we don't know like how many people watch anything. But I guess these shows were so big and they just weren't drawing in enough new subscribers or anything like that, that it ended up just not working out. And this is a bummer. I mean, I never watched The Get Down, but I am a big fan of Sense8. Sense8 is a great show. And I've not watched season 2 yet. I've only seen season 1 and the Christmas special.
Right.
But it was a phenomenal show. And also, I felt like it was a show that like we needed right now, in a way. Because it was so much about diversity and empathy. And like it was just really about togetherness. And it was about love. And it was so nice.
Just the shared human experience.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is—the shared human experience. So that's a bummer. And of course, I love the Wachowskis like to death. Like they're two of my favorite filmmakers, and so that is incredibly upsetting. And there was a little bit of bad optics there. I think it was like June is considered Pride Month, and it was like the second day of Pride Month, and Netflix canceled their Sense8, a show which is. Partially about celebrating the gay experience and also a show that's developed by two trans women. That show just got axed. So that was a little bit of bad optics on Netflix's part. But I don't think that was intentional. I think that was just like that. It's just the way it was going to be.
Bad timing.
yeah, bad timing. But yeah, we've talked a lot about how Netflix is burning money, and it looks like they may have actually realized how much money that they were burning.
I mean, it's the thing that's so so interesting and weird about like just the Netflix model, right? They're like, we talk about how they have, if there's a bajillion million Netflix originals released every day, but they already have our money. So like making the new shows, like if a show doesn't bring in new subscribers, like you mentioned, like it's not worth anything, but it's just, I don't know. It's just a weird thing to think about where it's always, you know, traditionally it's ratings, how many people are seeing the thing, make it determine its value. But for Netflix, that doesn't really mean anything, which I guess is why they don't release those numbers and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, basically their business model has to be on either getting new subscribers, which at this point I feel like is a limited number because everybody has Netflix, right?
Yeah, that's like, or maintaining is got to be the other.
Yeah, or keeping subscribers, and
yeah.
I feel like that's a cheaper prop. Like you don't need to spend millions of dollars an episode on something like that. If you have like, if you have like three or four shows that a person will want to watch, they will probably keep a Netflix subscription.
Yeah,
for the year, you know, it's
if there were only 10 shows that were House of Cards and, you know, those kind of level, Bloodlines, maybe. I haven't watched that, but I know that's a really popular one also. Well,
that's another one they ended, actually. They canceled Bloodline.
Oh, really? All right, maybe not Bloodlines. But you know what I mean? Like those top-tier, upper-echelon Netflix shows. If they only made 10 of those, that's enough to keep people around forever.
Right.
Orange is the New Black, and I'll throw BoJack on there just for you.
Thanks.
But instead, they, I think...
it said they made 400, and...
Yeah, in an effort to be... that should be lauded, I think. They just were like, we're going to fucking make whatever we want, and it's going to be awesome, usually. so that's cool.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's tragic that we're going to lose some cool shows, from what I've heard.
Yeah, Sense8 was phenomenal, and I heard The Get Down was very good, too. I never watched it. That's developed by Baz Luhrmann, guy in Moulin Rouge, Great Gatsby, and all those movies, and... So I'm not a big fan of Baz Luhrmann, but The Get Down sounded really intriguing in any case. And so, but I know that show was like the most expensive show, I think maybe ever.
Just in the history of ever.
I know that one cost like $14 million an episode or something.
Holy shit.
I know Sense8 cost like $9 million an episode. So they were both very, very expensive shows. So it makes sense that they were cut. But they were also like such pure, unfiltered visions from artists who are very distinctive. And so that's... kind of a blow. And I will say, speaking of pure unfiltered artists that have a really distinctive vision going on, Twin Peaks is airing on Showtime right now, and it's amazing.
Like, we're not in discussions yet.
I know. I'll talk about Twin Peaks some in discussions. But like, it does blow my mind that Showtime just gave David Lynch a blank canvas and all the money and said, like, here, make Twin Peaks. Do whatever you want. And he's like,
we're not going to be able to tell you what to do anyway. Yeah. Go do it.
Yeah. Yes. So I did want to mention that. And then I do want to mention some very sad news. Adam West, the iconic Batman actor from the old TV show and from Batman, the movie from 1966, died this past week at the age of 88. And that was very upsetting. Batman 66 is a formative movie for me. I love that movie. I'm pretty sure it's the first Batman movie I ever saw.
Wow.
And I loved it as a kid. That was a thing where I think my dad showed it to me on TCM one day, and it was like, I was probably like 6 or 7. So it was like Robert Osborne, the host. I distinctly remember Robert Osborne, the TCM host, introducing Batman the movie. Like, that's like a childhood memory. And so Batman 66 is amazing. Like, that's have you seen Batman the movie 66?
No, I have not.
Really? Okay, man, that is a perfect movie. it is wonderful.
All right, add it to the list after between Citizen Kane and Spider-Man 2. Batman 66.
It's added to the list. Yeah, it's on Netflix too. If you ever want to watch it,
I think I've seen that. For that, it's on there.
But yeah, it's pretty great. And plus, you know, he was so. I think he's a lot like Roger Moore, you know, or Leonard Nimoy, two of those other who both recently died. You know, they were both all people who leaned into their iconic role after they were done with the role.
Right.
You know, they're like, a lot of Adam West's career is playing on the fact that he is Adam West, or that he was Batman at some point. You know, he would appear on The Simpsons a couple times. He appeared on The Fairly OddParents a few times. He's also very well known for appearing on Family Guy as Mayor Adam West, the mayor of Quahog. And I stopped watching Family Guy years ago, but Adam West was always hilarious on Family Guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was like consistently one of the best parts of the show.
Absolutely. That's my most vivid memories of him is from Family Guy. Yeah. Just because I haven't, like I said, I didn't see Batman 66, the movie. I have seen episodes of the Batman TV series. Maybe it was on like at night or something like that. It did a run there. I don't really remember.
Right.
So that's not a nostalgic or formative experience, you know, that series for me personally. But I still am thankful for the cultural impact it had. And like a lot like Star Trek, the original series for me. That's not something I've seen a lot of, and it's not something that particularly hits home for me, but for what it did and what it represents, I am grateful for it.
Yeah. I mean, every Batman since Adam West Batman is almost like a reaction to that show.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because that show was so campy and so silly, and so it leaned into like parody. It's basically a parody of Batman in a lot of points.
Yeah.
And that's very much intentional. Like, that was the idea behind that show. But that also launched Batman into the mainstream. Like, he became a mainstream character from that show. And then after that, you know, that's, you know, Tim Burton went with the dark direction, Michael Keaton as like kind of a pushback to the campiness. And then Joel Schumacher went back to the campiness. And then Christopher Nolan went to the darkness. And then Snyderverse went way headfirst into the darkness. And
yeah. It didn't rebound the other way.
Yeah, it did not rebound the other way. So maybe we're due for another rebound, an Adam West style Batman. Who knows? I mean, maybe that's Lego Batman, but.
I mean, you're not wrong, though.
Yeah.
I saw a really touching piece of fan art that came out that was all of the Batmans throughout the years, and you know, at Adam West's grave, I think it was, and Lego Batman was included in that piece of fan art. So I think it's, you know, you mentioned that it's one of the best. I remember when you talked about Lego Batman with like the finger on the pulse of Batman.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah. So that's I did actually see somebody tweet that all of the Batman should have to attend Adam West's funeral, like when a former president dies.
All the presidents have to go.
Yeah, all the presidents have to go. So they all have to go, but they all have to be dressed as Batman.
As Batman,
and they have
of course.
To all be the pallbearers, I would imagine.
Yes, that'd be the best.
Be the most epic way to go. And like I've been, like people have been tweeting a lot of Adam West stories, and they've all been like pretty fantastic. There's this one story that's been going around online where there was a story about how Adam West and Frank Gorshin, who played the Riddler on the Batman TV show, got kicked out of a Hollywood orgy for staying in character as Batman.
Yeah, they wouldn't. That's the best mental image, just in general.
That is insane. And I was also, this isn't about Adam West specifically, but Drew McWeeny, who is a critic I follow, who I used to work for HitFlix, he tweeted this story about how he went to go visit the set of Kick-Ass, and we'll talk about this eventually when we get to our Complete Works episode of Kick-Ass. But Nicolas Cage is doing an Adam West accent in that movie.
Wow!
When he's doing Big Daddy. And, like, Drew McWeeny is talking about his experience being on the set and, like, accidentally ruining a take because he laughed so hard when he first heard Nicolas Cage's Adam West voice. And Cage, like, came up to him and seemed, like, angry at him at first. And he's like, why did you laugh at that? And Drew McWeeny's like, it's Adam West. And then Cage smiled and was like, yeah.
That's the best thing ever. Yeah.
So Adam West was like the great unifier.
Yeah,
it was really cool. And he, you know, a lot of his like non-Batman stuff, like he did a lot of like really interesting B movies in the 60s and 70s too that are worth a look too. He did this movie called Robinson Crusoe on Mars, which I watched a few years back. It's part of the Criterion Collection. Really, really good sci-fi movie, and he plays like this, very ill-fated astronauts in that movie. It's good stuff. But yeah, so RIP Adam West. I think we've said a lot of things.
Yeah.
And we should probably move on, Mike, into our discussion.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time to move on into our discussions for Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
So today, I have to discuss Life's Been Hard, Mike. Things are happening. Lots of plates spinning. Not a whole lot of time. But I do have time to talk about The Leftovers series finale, the last half of the season.
Yes.
Season 3. The show does not exist anymore. Where no new shows, episodes will happen. It's still available
and
places.
And also, no TV shows will ever be made ever again. This is
ever again. This is the Spider-Man 2 of television, Mike. So they
that's gotta
finished.
That's got to be the new running joke. This is the Spider-Man 2 of this thing.
We have to fill the void that the Snyderverse jokes will have left behind.
I feel like we might not be able to avoid Snyderverse jokes for that.
Well, Joe, maybe not jokes, but I think we can critically engage in Snyderverse discussions.
We can still use the word Snyderverse, right?
Yeah, that's not what we're talking about. I just don't want to make light of hardship that he's experiencing.
Sure, absolutely. Okay.
That said, Leftovers season 3, it ended. Cried many tears, lots of cries. I don't even know what to talk about, Mike. I watched the last, I think, two episodes back to back.
That's gotta be an experience.
Yeah. If you ever wanted to question whether or not anything is real, and if life is worth living, watch those two episodes back to back. Don't spit on your computer, Mike. That would be the best thing ever. it's hard to talk about The Leftovers without being, you know, especially the series finale, the end of the show, without getting into spoilery specific things.
Let's say we'll get into spoilers for The Leftovers, just because if anybody wants to watch The Leftovers, you definitely should. So if you haven't watched it and you want to watch it, which you should, pause the podcast.
watch all 18 episodes. No, 28
episodes. I think. And then come back and unpause the podcast or just skip ahead a few minutes.
Yeah, either.
talk about The Leftovers, Mike. What did you want to discuss, spoilery-wise?
Did Nora go to the place? Is that real? Is everything crazy?
I don't know. Yeah, so...
A recurring theme throughout the whole show, a refrain that comes up that from Lori, she mentions... if someone's having a psychotic break, you run with it. You engage them. You don't try to tell them it's fake.
Right.
And then we get that last, I don't know, half hour, 20 minutes, where someone somewhere is having a psychotic break, probably. and we're just, you just go along with it. And it's insane.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite possibly a psychotic break. I don't know. When I watched it, I felt like she probably did go to the place.
Probably.
And then as time went on, I was like, but did she? I don't know. Because the thing about it is very deliberate. So the way they play this out in the episode is, it's the episode shows Nora, Carrie Coon's character, at the beginning she walks into this tub and she's about to cross over to the other side where the other people had disappeared to. And she's going to finally find out what happened to her whole family. And then the episode picks up 20 years later. But you don't realize that. You just see an old Nora and she's all alone and you don't even know if this is the real world or not, if she's still on the other side or anything. And then Kevin shows up and it's an older Kevin too. And he's talking to Nora as if they haven't known each other for the entire show. Like if they just met in their first episode and never spoke again. And so it's very confusing. You don't know what's happening for a long time, which happens a lot with The Leftovers.
True.
Until it is eventually revealed that this is all a ruse on Kevin's part, and this is actually the real world that she's in. And then the episode ends with this, I want to say it's, at least 10 to 15 minutes of just Nora talking about what happened when she went to the
machine. Yeah, telling the story.
And so the concept behind the show is that 2% of the world's population disappeared 7 years ago. And for Nora, that was her whole family. And so she was Nora Cursed was her she was the unluckiest person in the world, basically.
Right.
But then she reveals she went over to the other side, and it turns out in that world, that 2% didn't disappear, but the other 98% of the world did.
Right.
And that's not even a concept I had ever considered.
Never once. Never once did I think about the 2% that left here. Actually lost the 98%. It was insane.
That blew my mind. And then it just keeps going for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
She describes her experience there, and it is mind-boggling. Carrie Coon, there are not enough Emmys to give.
just for that scene alone.
Just for that scene. Really for the whole show. She's been MVP from day one. Her and Christopher Eccleston, they've both been just killer. But I she really brought it in that last 10 minutes, and it's entirely fueled by her performance too. Because they make it a very deliberate choice to not show anything that happened in that other side. You just see Carrie Coon telling the story, and it's a 10 minute thing. And so, you know, and like, I thought at some point maybe they would show, like, you know, Carrie Coon in the other world or something, but like, no, it's so that, yeah, that leaves it open to interpretation about whether she's making it all up or whether she actually did go over. And at the end of the day, it probably doesn't matter. That's kind of the Leftovers MO.
Right. Yeah. It's whatever you make of it. Right. I guess, I don't know. There's just that the final thing is, I think it's the final, you know, moment where Kevin just kind of like shakes his head and is like, yeah, I believe you. And they like hold hands and then we just pan out the window and the show ends. Yeah, it's just like, what? Insane.
It is nuts. And yeah, and the whole thing behind the Leftovers, I mean, just the let the mystery be aspect of it, you know, leave it to the Leftovers to kind of finally answer the mystery and then create a whole new one that'll just, yeah, never be answered.
Yeah, and it's also one of the, you know, the few shows to, I think, honestly, I think we might have talked about this last time, I don't remember, honestly and openly deal with religion and faith and not come down on either side. It just kind of presents you with examples of both cases, and you just have to figure out, yeah, you know, what applies to you and how that makes you feel and stuff.
Yeah, the Matt-centered episode, I think it's episode 5, where he's on the boat, and he confronts a guy who's claiming to be God, is like, incredible. Like that's another incredible episode. But yeah, and then there's the whole in episode 7, the it's Kevin in the afterlife again. And that was awesome. And again, like, the show is also really funny.
Like, hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
It's also really like the bit with the penis scanner in episode 7. And just the sound design of that scene where he's confused for a second. They need to like scan his penis in order to let him through a door. And then you just hear him unzip his pants and then you just hear thunk, like,
like a weighty, heavy,
like a weighty thunk.
Yeah. It's hilarious.
It's pretty great. But yeah,
that's the Leftovers for you.
That is the Leftovers series finale the final season. That was an incredible show. I think one of the best shows that I've ever seen. So
yeah,
that is the Leftovers. And then I have a few shows I wanted to talk about too, Mike. Twin Peaks. I wanted to. I am going to use my discussions as like kind of a placeholder just to remind people that Twin Peaks exists and it is awesome every week.
Yeah, that's fair. The public service announcement.
Yeah. So since we last talked about them, episodes 5 and 6 have aired, and I am continually struck every time by just how hypnotizing David Lynch can be. It's actually like insane, especially with a series that seems like almost designed to test the viewer's patience at this point. I've seen people like, I spend a lot of time reading about Twin Peaks at this point, which I like, so nothing has changed for me really, but like now there's new Twin Peaks to read about. I see a lot of people discussing Twin Peaks. Like I spend a lot of time in like comments boards and like people like arguing about what's happening. And like a lot of the time, I would say like 40% of the comments would be like, I don't know why I'm still watching this. I don't get it. Like, what's happening? This is ridiculous. Nothing is going on. And those people are fools. Like,
what a bunch of chumps.
I mean, they're just so many arresting shots. There's images from these last two episodes that are just like seared into my brain. And I won't go into specifics because you haven't seen them yet.
Yeah.
But like, there is some incredible stuff. And I really hope you catch up very, very soon because like, oh my God, dude, it is.
So, we got to talk about it.
We got to talk about it. Like, I never know what to expect from a given episode, and it's already 6 episodes in. You know, I feel like at this point I should know a little bit about what to expect. I don't know a single thing. Like, my only thing is that like I can probably expect Cooper to show up at some point. Right?
Seems fair.
And even that is questionable. let's say I can probably expect Kyle MacLachlan to show up at some point.
Sure. That seems.
Yeah, and then, you know, I like there are characters who popped up in one episode that I have not seen since, and like will, and I don't know if I'll ever see them again. Like it's the kind of thing where it's like that, and I am so blown away by it every week. I never know what to expect, but I'm always left like breathless at the end. Literally, I noticed this during the last episode I watched, and I noticed that I've been doing this every time. I breathe this huge sigh of relief when the credits roll every time.
You made it. Made it through another one.
It is intense, and it's an intense experience. So I'm so glad that David Lynch is back doing his thing. Twin Peaks episodes 5 and 6 continue to be great. They're very different than what the show started out as. Like even like episodes 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 are like, I feel like it's like the show is evolving as it's going on. And it's also David Lynch has talked about this being like an 18-hour movie, and it feels like it. Like it's not as episodic as television usually is, which is something that I usually dislike. You know, I like having an episodic format to TV because that's how TV generally works. But this is so this feels like such a mold breaking, like groundbreaking thing that like I can't judge it by that merit, and I am just I'm having so much fun. And so I'm so terrified every week. Like every week, I'm like guaranteed to see at least something that will terrify me and something that will make me laugh really hard. Possibly within the span of like 5 minutes of each other.
Maybe at the same time.
Maybe at the same time. Yeah. So that's Twin Peaks. Just wanted to throw that in there. I'll probably talk about it again. Episode 7 and 8 roll around. But yeah. And then I have a couple of movies I wanted to discuss as well. I saw Colossal a couple weeks ago. Which is the new movie directed by Nacho Vigalondo, who had a movie a few years ago called Time Crimes. And this one stars Anne Hathaway, Jason Sudeikis, Dan Stevens, and Tim Blake Nelson. Now, Mike, have you seen anything about Colossal?
Yeah, I saw some trailers and I saw some reactions to it.
Okay. So you know what the premise of the movie is, right?
Yes, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so in this movie, Hathaway's life is a mess. She moves back to her hometown after her boyfriend kicks her out of the apartment. And this is a really novel film. If you don't know anything about it, skip ahead, because I am going to go a little more in-depth. This stuff is in the trailer, but if you don't know the premise, like it would be really fun to discover this on your own, I think. When she moves back home, a giant monster appears in South Korea at the same time. And it turns out she shares a mental connection to the monster. So she is like sort of in control of the monster's actions. And the movie goes in a lot of places that I did not expect. When you expect it to be one thing, it suddenly becomes... a whole different thing. It takes a pivot and it becomes a better and stronger thing. I highly recommend checking this out, especially if you like the idea of subverting monster movies on a low budget human scale. It's really interesting on that front. So Colossal, definitely worth checking out. And then I also wanted to mention It Comes at Night, which is the new horror thriller film from director Trey Edward Schultz, and also from A24. The studio stars Joel Edgerton, Carmen Ejogo, Riley Keough, and Christopher Abbott from Girls. That was kind of cool to see him. This kind of plays like a much more grim and effective episode of The Walking Dead, which is great for a 90-minute movie, not so great for a 7-season TV show.
So
you haven't seen anything about It Comes at Night, Mike? You haven't seen any trailers or anything?
No, I remember seeing the poster for it posted online and thinking that it was one of the best posters I'd ever seen, because it tells you nothing other than makes me tense, scared, creeped out.
Right.
So I was excited just by that, because, you know, I think good posters are kind of rare, especially posters that actually elicit emotions that I think the movie would have. So I've been avoiding trailers. I want to go in and sell it and stuff. And then I'm not so sure that it's going to have been worth it. I don't know. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, so it's not really the movie that's being sold in the trailer. And the trailer is, you know, it's a lot of, like, shots of darkness and, like, atmospheric stuff. And it looks like a pretty, and the trailer makes it look like a pretty straight-ahead horror movie. But this is really much more of a very small family drama that kind of turns into a thriller. But it's about two families trying to coexist together after a deadly disease has wiped out what appears to be most of humanity. And it's a pretty straightforward but very well-executed thriller that pissed off just about everybody in my theater except for me.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
And that seems to be a lot of people's experience with the movie. Like, every time I go, like, if I see somebody on Twitter tweet about it, you know, I follow a lot of, like, film people and, like, people who are into movies and stuff. And almost every reaction to it from those people is like, wow, It Comes at Night was great. Everybody in my theater hated it. It is not for a mainstream audience, to say the least. But for people who are interested in, like, more intense or incredibly depressing horror, without giving the audience any form of, like, real catharsis, this one is for you. And I dug it quite a bit. So definitely, I think It Comes at Night is well worth checking out.
Okay, that's different from what I was expecting.
What were you expecting me to say?
The few people I saw said that it was like it got a D on CinemaScore or something, and like
that's because it's not for a mainstream audience. CinemaScore, So CinemaScore, I mean, you're familiar with CinemaScore? That's basically like
it's like exit polls for the movies.
Yeah, and like that's like audience reactions, and almost always movies that have a low CinemaScore. Not almost always, but like a lot of times. Movies that have a pretty low CinemaScore are actually great.
That's fair.
I'm pretty sure The Witch got a D on CinemaScore also.
That makes sense.
And The Witch is also A24. It's the same studio. And I think this is kind of a piece with that movie. Okay. I don't think it's as good as The Witch, but I think it is kind of in the same vein. So there's that as well. But yeah, I feel like CinemaScore, when the movie isn't exactly like what the trailer promised, a lot of times the cinema score will be pretty low. And I think It Comes at Night is that. I mean, they don't even tell you what comes at night.
It does.
You have to decide for yourself what it is. But I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in this movie. And so definitely, I highly recommend checking it out, unless you are of the 95% of people who won't like the movie.
So you're telling me that it lived up to its poster, Mike?
I would say yes. I think it's a good poster, too. So.
Fair enough.
So that's It Comes at Night, and I think that wraps up our discussions, Mike. Let's move on into our featured review of Wonder Woman.
What is your mission?
To stop the war.
What war?
The war to end all wars.
Weapons far deadlier than you can ever imagine.
The war can be ours.
Whoever you are in more danger than you think.
I cannot stand by while innocent lives are lost.
Be careful, Diana.
Who is this woman?
She's my secretary, sir. She's a very good secretary.
All right, that was from the trailer for Wonder Woman, the new film directed by Patty Jenkins. It stars Gal Gadot. I just found out that I've been saying Gal Gadot wrong this entire time. I've been saying Gadot.
Yeah, I've just been waiting for her to show up.
Good stuff. But since Gal Gadot is Israeli and not French, it's not a silent T. It's a hard T.
This changes everything, right?
I know. We can't make those waiting for Gadot jokes anymore. Have to be waiting for Gadot. Let's go back to the drawing board. I had so many jokes.
Throw it all out.
It stars Gal Gadot, Chris Pine, Robin Wright, Danny Houston, David Thewlis, Connie Nielsen, and Elena Anaya, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Wonder Woman reads, "Before she was Wonder Woman, she was Diana, princess of the Amazons, trained warrior. When a pilot crashes and tells of conflict in the outside world, she leaves home to fight a war to end all wars, discovering her full powers and true destiny."
Good job, IMDb.
That is a quality plot synopsis. I feel like I just watched the movie again.
Yeah.
So it has been truly kind of remarkable the reaction this movie has gotten, which is a combination of a lot of different factors kind of piling in all at once. First off, this is the first solo female superhero movie in the golden age of superhero movies, which I'm calling this now. I don't think there's any disputing that we're in the golden age of superhero movies at this point.
No, you're definitely not wrong.
You know, there's so many of them, and so many of them are good that it's like, oh man. But there have been other solo female superhero movies. There was Supergirl in 1984, Catwoman and Elektra. All of those were bad. And there hasn't really been anything like that since I would say the golden age started in like 2008, right? That's when Iron Man and The Dark Knight both came out. And since then, like, Iron Man became such a huge success and it kind of like spawned the entire MCU, and everybody's been trying to chase after the MCU and like copying them. So I feel like that would be a good starting point for what the golden age is from then until question mark. So I think this is the first of its kind in this new golden age of superhero movies.
Sorry, I just thought of a really dumb joke that I made to myself, and it made me laugh.
Mike. Well, you got to share the joke now, Mike.
It's from 2008 till we get to the Spider-Man 2 of superhero movies.
Yeah, fair enough. This movie has a female director in Patty Jenkins. And we're in a time when it's pretty well publicized how rare that is in Hollywood these days, especially for a big blockbuster. So I think that has helped the movie a little bit too. And the current political climate, I think, has created an environment in which I think people need to see a movie like Wonder Woman. They need to see a powerful woman on screen this. I think that's also a factor. And finally, I think it's also a reaction to the current state of the DC movies, which has mostly gotten pretty mixed to bad reviews on average up to this point. You know, people were hungry for DC to have a win, I think. So I love the reaction this movie has gotten and the effect that it's had. You know, I keep seeing stories about kids reacting to the movie, and it's all very powerful. And I think that's great. You know, I see stories of like, little girls like dressing up as Wonder Woman and going to school and all this like Wonder Woman related things about like little kids, and that's great. That's exactly what I want a superhero movie to do, basically. I didn't love Wonder Woman to the degree that many others did, but I found a lot to like in it. I did enjoy the movie quite a bit. And I found myself liking a DC movie for the first time since The Dark Knight Rises, which is nice.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too. Just, you know, one of the other things, in the lead up to the release that, you know, there were the people were speculating, will the gamble of Patty Jenkins directing this movie pay off? Meanwhile, like, the biggest thing the Russos directed before Ultron was, like, the Community paintball episodes. Yeah. Like,
that was a weird, like, oddly sexist article. Because that's not even just the Russos. Like, that's a common practice in Hollywood now to get somebody who did, like, one small-scale indie movie or has done some TV work.
Yeah, and Gareth Edwards made Monsters. Give him Star Wars. Colin Trevorrow made
Safety Not Guaranteed.
Sure, why not?
So it was a weird thing. Plus, I mean, Patty Jenkins had also directed Monster, the movie of Charlize Theron, which was a huge thing. I mean, that was the last movie she directed, which was 2003. But that was a huge movie. That was nominated for a lot of Oscars. I think did Charlize Theron win an Oscar for that movie?
I think she did. She was definitely nominated. I don't remember if she won or not.
I'm pretty sure she won that Oscar. But yeah, so it's been a long time since Patty Jenkins has made a movie. She's mostly done some TV work. She also directed the pilot of The Killing. And she was she directed an episode of Arrested Development, I think, in season 2, something like that. She was attached to make Thor 2. Thor the Dark World was going to be her next movie. And there was a whole hullabaloo around around Thor 2. Because that was a thing where, like, Natalie Portman brought her on board, and that was, like, a very exciting thing for the two of them. Like, Natalie Portman wanted a female director for it. It was very important for her. And then Patty Jenkins and Marvel just kept clashing about the kind of movie they wanted to make. And then eventually... and this happened a few times with Marvel. It's happened a lot more with DC, but it's happened a few times with Marvel. Most famously with Edgar Wright and Ant-Man. You know, Patty Jenkins parted ways with Marvel and she left because she didn't think she would deliver the movie that she wanted to make. And so I think that was pretty interesting. And that could have been Thor 2 could have been the first movie of the golden age of superhero movies to have a female director, and it wasn't. And it's been 4 years since then, and still nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing since. And that was, I think that also is part of the reason why Natalie Portman is not in Thor 3, is because she didn't even want to do Thor 2, but then when they got Patty Jenkins on board, she was like, okay, I'll stay for this. And then she left and she was kind of unhappy about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm pretty excited that Patty Jenkins got like a huge shot with this Wonder Woman movie. Like, I think that's pretty cool. And I want to say a lot of the reason that I like this movie, it's all on Gal Gadot. Gal Gadot, who is incredibly dynamic as Wonder Woman, I think.
Yeah.
You know, a lot.
Yeah. Just to, you know, I didn't get a chance to say my opinions and general stuff.
Sorry, man.
No, it's fine. I do think that you're right that most of this movie hinges on Chris Pine and Gal Gadot's chemistry. And I think that them together is one of the most joyous things to behold.
just two
of the most impossibly beautiful humans being impossibly beautiful together.
Yes.
And I think you're right, too, just that you mentioned that is this Wonder Woman feels like a response to the criticisms of the DC EU or whatever they're calling it now, the European Union of the... of DC.
Yep,
that's the one.
You got it.
And part of that response is those characters, is Diana and Steve Trevor, I think is his name. And they're funny, and it's fun to watch them together, right? That's always the thing we talked about with Batman vs. Superman and Suicide Squad, is those characters are so dour and depressing, and we're some kind of Suicide Squad. is the level of writing we're talking about. And in this movie, there is joy in Wonder Woman. And much of it is Gal Gadot being, at the same time, being naive and powerful and awestruck at ice cream cones, right? Like the simple, it's the really simple, the human moments for this literal god that are so much fun to behold.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, Gal Gadot is... fantastic in this movie. A lot of people pointed to her as a highlight in Batman vs. Superman when she appeared in that movie. But I always felt she had nothing to do there. Like, she didn't make that much of an impression on me in that movie because she just didn't have anything to do. She had, like...
literally, yeah.
She had, like, 12 minutes of screen time and, like, 10 lines of dialogue, and that was, like...
Yeah, and 7 of those minutes are watching trailers for other movies.
That, too. So it was tough to gauge. Here, I think she really comes into her own. And is excellent every step of the way. And she was always excellent. Like, she was great in the Fast and Furious movies. You know, she's always been good. But I feel like this is, like, the real star-making term for Gal Gadot. She's excellent every step of the way in this movie. Likewise, Chris Pine is great in this movie, too. He's a great foil for her. And the two are very funny together when they need to be. I think the movie does suffer from many of these same problems that plague the other DC Universe movies. In my opinion, you know, after we leave Themyscira, which I think the stuff in Themyscira is the best stuff in the movie. It's so good. After we leave that, though, I feel like the color palette becomes a lot more muted.
Yeah.
The color of the movie just becomes very, like, dimmer. Like, they just, like, turned off the dimmer switch in the camera or something. and I think that does make the movie lose some of its visual punch. There is a completely unnecessary framing device with this really lame voiceover that exists, like, just to make sure we know that's connected to the other movies. It appears at the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
And I do think the movie kind of falls apart in Act 3 with a final fight that's one beam in the sky away from being the exact same as every other superhero movie ending.
And we're real close. We come real close to that, too.
It actually, like, specifically, it really reminded me of the Doomsday fight at the end of Batman vs. Superman. Just visually, I feel like that's what it kind of looked like to me. But there is, like, this pervading sense of, like, hope and optimism throughout this movie that is really absent in those other DC movies. And, you know, there are sequences in this movie that are incredible because of Godot's performance and what we get to see her do. Like, we'll talk about it in spoilers. The No Man's Land sequence is already on its way to being iconic, I think.
I think it's there, yeah. It's been a week, and it's already iconic.
Yeah.
I was completely overwhelmed with emotions in the first, I don't know, minute and a half of this movie, with young Diana running through the streets of Themyscira, and she comes across the training ground of the Amazons.
Right.
And they're being just fucking badass. I can't imagine what those things, what they're doing. You know, they're the you know, Amazon's bred to do or created for battle, and they're being badass in badass Amazon ways.
Yeah.
But then there's the moment where Diana starts, like, throwing punches and kicks and, like, mimicking them, and just in that one shot of just complete, it hit me so hard that is the thing that every girl or woman, young girl watching this movie is doing, right? They are Diana in that moment, finally seeing a badass warrior, strong, powerful women presented on screen for a large audience.
Yeah.
And just how important that was. And that's in, I think, the first 2 minutes or minute 45 seconds or whatever. Yeah. And it just hit me really hard. So that's what this movie represents, right? Even though it has the DC flaws that I think we'll get into in spoilers, it is somehow greater than all of the, you know, all of those for what it represents and what it means.
Yeah, no, I agree with that very much. And I also really like there's this internal conflict going on with Diana that goes through as she grapples with the idea that humanity is flawed and is prone to violence. And as an outsider, she can't understand that. And for much of the movie, she won't accept it. And I found that to be a really engaging aspect, too. So this movie is, like, more thematically complex than I think a lot of other superhero movies tend to be. Marvel has kind of flirted with going a little more thematically into some more interesting places thematically with some of the more recent movies. And, like, Logan was very good about that kind of thing. But, like, you know, I feel, you know, like, what is Suicide Squad trying to say? You know, like, what?
Yeah.
Shop at Hot Topic? That's not a theme.
I guess that's it.
So I think that concept is really interesting, and the way that Godot plays it is really good. I found it very similar to, I mean, you've watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer, right?
Yes, I have.
There's the episode where Buffy's mom dies, which is one of the most heart-wrenching episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, one of the most heart-wrenching TV episodes ever. There's the character Anya, who is a demon, and she has to, like, grapple with and understand the concept of death in that episode, and it is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And it kind of, I got a similar vibe from this movie, the way, like, Diana doesn't really understand the concept of war and why humanity is prone to going to war. And so I think there's a similar push and pull there, which is really cool.
Yeah, and I think the most important thing that the movie does in terms of that theme, right, is that, you know, Diana starts in a black and white world, and she confronts that flaw, or, you know, humanity's flaws in general, many flaws that she comes across.
Right.
And still decides that humanity is worth it, you know, like, is worth being with, or whatever, however you want to put it. And I think I feel like that is the direct response. That is the criticism. That is the Snyderverse. That is the other DC movies that, even though, you know, Batman vs. Superman, like, they almost are destroyed by the fact that they are these heroes and, like, seem to regret it from the stuff that we are shown. And they, like, hate that they must wear this mantle. And Wonder Woman fully embraces it and is like, no, this is the point of this character, is to embrace that, man, to take on the hardship for us and to pull us up out of the trenches. And, you know, and it's what we need, I think, in these movies, and especially just in the world right now, as you mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, it's hopeful and it's inspirational. And that's something that I think is, you know, that goes a long way, I think, for this kind of movie. And so that's very exciting. It actually, I mean, it's kind of a piece with a lot of the DC TV shows, specifically Supergirl, actually, weirdly enough. Like, Supergirl kind of covers a lot of the same, like, hope and optimism stuff that this movie covers pretty well. And so actually, Supergirl also has a scene where the character freaks out about ice cream. But that's now that I'm thinking about it. But yeah, so that's I did want to mention the action in this movie too, which is pretty well done. It actually feels more Zack Snyder-y than the Zack Snyder movies in this franchise do.
Absolutely. I was thinking of 300 during almost every battle scene, because they do that slow down, and in 300 it's to recreate panels in the comic, as we've talked about.
Here it's just because it looks cool, but like
it looks fucking badass.
It's speed ramping is what that's called, where it slows down and then speeds up.
Okay.
You're talking about? It's speed ramping. And that's something that, like, Zack Snyder, you know, basically pioneered with 300. And, you know, he did it again in Watchmen, but he kind of ditched that in Man of Steel and Batman for Superman. Like, I don't remember any stuff. Like, there might have been, like, a little bit of Batman for Superman.
Maybe.
But I feel like that it's mostly not there. But in this, like, this one goes all in. I think that's kind of interesting. Zack Snyder does have a story credit on this movie.
Okay.
So he is involved in some capacity. I know he's basically, like, the godfather of this. He's the Snyderverse.
I think it is interesting too, though, that it uses the speed ramping. It uses that device a lot and frequently. It has the potential to get old or feel stale, but because of the way the uniqueness and freshness of the action and like the physical way that Wonder Woman and the Amazons are moving and fighting, that device does not feel old to me. The way it's used in this is so unique and fresh that it breathes some more life into the DC universe.
I agree. And yeah, I mean, I pretty much loved like everything on Themyscira. Like Themyscira, like to me, like
that's, oh man,
it's so colorful, first of all.
Yeah,
like, it's so colorful and there's so much cool shit happening. And like I really dig the World War One setting that happens afterwards. I wish we could go back to Themyscira at some point. I feel like, you know, we leave it and then that's just kind of it. Like, there's no closure on what happens to the Amazons. Like, nothing really has to happen to the Amazons. There's nothing like there's no like dangling thread left there, but it would have been nice to just see her like go
just
back.
Give me a medal ceremony or something.
Just recreate the end of Star Wars.
But I do think you're right that Themyscira is bright blue and bright green and white, like bright fluorescent white, but you know what I mean. White cliffs. And it's the much-needed injection of life and color into these movies that we do leave behind to go to the grays and browns and blacks of the rest of the DC movies.
Right.
But it fits the World War One setting, and it
it
feels much more excusable. I don't know if that's the right word. Believable. I'm more willing to forgive the movie for that color palette in a World War One movie. Versus downtown Metropolis, or Gotham, or wherever they're fighting in that like abandoned island or whatever the hell. In Batman versus Superman.
I'd agree with that. I mean, it does fit the setting a lot better than it does in something like Man of Steel, Batman versus Superman. The color palette of it fits this World War One setting. I just feel like since we've seen it in those other movies, it just feels like kind of a piece with them, and so it's a little. I did also want to mention the special effects aren't the best in this movie. There's some iffy CGI bits. There's some green screen stuff that happens, like where they're driving and things like that. And so, you can almost chalk it up to being like, well, it takes place during World War One, so maybe it's like a throwback to like film serials of the 30s or something.
Sure, we can pretend that's what they thought.
But I think at the end, in actuality, I think Warner Brothers didn't put as much money behind this as they did, you know, Batman Superman or Suicide Squad or something like that.
And I don't understand. I mean, I guess I do because the world sucks that they wouldn't put money behind this, but it's just the point I'm going to make, you know, I hate to compare it to the Marvel movies, but you can't help but doing that, I guess.
Sure.
You know, the big climax of Civil War, let's say, is a bunch of CG characters fighting in front of on the tarmac of a CG airport.
Well, that's the pre-climax of Civil War.
Well, okay, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The big moment, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, and in all the movies in general, the scene, the big, cool dolly shot, if you would, in Ultron when they're fighting over, like, the magnet. I can't even remember what it's called. when it's all the Ultron robots and it's the full of Avengers fighting, just spinning in a 360. Like, all of that is just computers. It's CGI stuff. It's green screen stuff. And yet, I guess because they got that Disney money, it looks beautiful and amazing. And when we get those kinds of things in the DC movies, it doesn't reach those levels. And I think leaves a lot to be desired and kind of hurts the movie, you know, in some way. Especially in the third act of this movie, I think, when we get to spoilers.
I mean, the thing is, like, that those, like, the somewhat shoddy CG effects, I never really felt that in the other DC movies. It kind of just felt, I just felt like it here. And so okay. I feel like that's something that's, like, you know, I don't think Warner Brothers thought this would be as big of a movie as it has turned out to be. I think, you know, look, like, comparatively to, like, a Marvel movie or something, maybe they thought this would be, like, it's Ant-Man, almost.
Which is, like, what the fuck?
Which is insulting. Like, that's,
yeah.
I mean, like, I love Ant-Man. That's a great movie. But, like, it's I'm not trying to diss Ant-Man here, but just Wonder Woman is one of the most iconic superheroes of all time. And she's never had a real movie before. And there was such an appetite for this. Like, it was clear over the past few weeks that there was a lot of appetite for this movie. People wanted this really badly. And so it's nuts to me that they didn't throw more money at this. But I'm sure they threw, like, a pretty penny at the movie. I didn't look at the budget or anything, but if I looked it up, I would bet that the budget for this movie is a lot less than whatever Batman v Superman's budget was.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is the whole point of why we need this movie.
Yeah, this movie was made on, 8/10 of what the Man superhero movie was made for. So,
insane.
At the end of the day, I do think it's a really well-executed, fairly standard superhero movie that is elevated both by Gal Gadot's performance, which is really incredible, Chris Pine as well, some really spectacular set pieces, and its place in history. I feel like this is something that's going to really, like, be looked at as, like, a formative movie for a lot of people.
I think we're going to have a pre and post Wonder Woman, specifically DC movies, but I think superhero movies and movies in general, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen like other, like, female superhero movies, like, in development before Wonder Woman came out. Like, Captain Marvel is happening at Marvel, and Sony's talking about that Black Cat Silver Sable movie, which definitely exists, I'm sure.
Nudge.
And then DC is even, I mean, Wonder Woman 2 will definitely happen. They're talking about Gotham City Sirens as well, which is another one. Then I feel like there's another DC movie that they were talking about that was the female-fronted thing, but I'm completely blanking on what it is. But the point is, I feel like there's more stuff happening. I think at this point, like, Marvel should probably greenlight a Black Widow movie at some point. I feel like it's almost insane that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah,
but
it would be dumb not to.
Yeah, that would make all the dollars.
Yeah,
every single one. There would be no dollars left because Black Widow.
Every single one of them.
The Black Widow movie would have them. So yeah, I think that about wraps up our general thoughts on Wonder Woman. Should we get into spoilers, Mike?
Yes.
Okay, let's do that. Let's get into spoilers for Wonder Woman starting right now. All right, spoilers for Wonder Woman starting right now. So that No Man's Land sequence, man. I mean, that was pretty nuts. That was pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah. It started off, right? So it's them in the trenches, and they Diana finds a civilian in the trenches there. It says that, you know, the whole town got enslaved by the Germans. And Diana says, I don't care what you say, we're going across the No Man's Land and to save the town. And Steve Trevor, Chris Pine, tells her, you know, that's no, she was one line away from, you know, I'm no man. She was 1 second. That was one second away.
That was almost definitely originally in the script. Like,
oh, yeah. Had to be. Absolutely had to be. Yeah, he says, you know, that's no man's land. That means no man can cross it. And there's a beat. There's a beat there where I was like, here we go.
Yeah, it's not subtle at all about what about what it's doing.
No, but I think that's an important...
No, 100%, yeah.
Yeah, the moment to have, right? Yeah. And she charges across, and it starts off, as I was going to say, It starts off as one of those, like, oh no, this is going to be a really bad CGI thing, where it's, I don't know, it's clearly her just marching in front of a green screen for a few seconds. And then we get into some really dynamic camera angles and stuff is happening and it looks really cool. Right. And it saves the rest of that scene,
yeah,
or that segment of the extended battle scene in the town, which I think that's my favorite part of the movie, when they liberate this town.
Yeah.
And she goes full Amazon for the first time, I think. That we get to see.
Right, she reveals her costume and everything, and it's this whole,
yeah,
whole thing. Yeah, I mean, that whole sequence was great. She exits the trench, marches on the Germans herself, deflects all the bullets with her wristbands, and is protecting the American and British army, and she's allowing the army to advance. And then that's followed by the whole sequence where they're liberating the village. It's great. You know, all the male characters are there to assist, but Wonder Woman is doing all the heavy lifting. Like, it's her show. And, you know, like, Chris... Like, what's kind of great about Chris Pine's character in this movie is he's, like... He is heroic in his own way, but he stays in his own lane. You know, what
I mean? Yeah.
Like everything he does is there to assist Wonder Woman in this movie, which is a good subversion of the trope of like the, you know, female side character who maybe does one or two things, but is kind of useless a lot of the time in a lot of these movies.
Is there to facilitate the male action hero's heroics, which Steve Trevor fully occupies that role in this movie, and it's amazing.
Yeah, and he has his own heroics, but it's always in service of what Wonder Woman is doing.
So,
and that's kind of an important note there.
There's that moment during the climax of that battle with the sniper in the bell tower, and they run over and use the door from the tank to do like the shield jump thing that he sees on the beach earlier in the Themyscira. And when that happened, just like an eruption of applause in my theater.
Really?
It was like the coolest thing ever. Yeah.
That's
it was
awesome.
The best. Yeah. And they're doing all this stuff. I mean, I looked over the theater I was at. It is one of those reclining seat theaters. And I looked over down my row because there was like a family next to me. And it was like the father and then like a son and then there was a daughter. And I happened to just glance over and look, and she must have been, I don't know, 7.
Yeah.
And she had the chair flat, and she was laying on her stomach with her elbows propped up, holding her head, like she was at home on the couch. And it was like the best. It was so cool just to see, watch her in that moment.
That's
as she, you know, Wonder Woman is that I think another iconic shot of her like kneeing the guy out the window during the liberation of the battle of that town. I don't know. It's just moments like that that make this movie, elevate this movie beyond its third act problems.
Yes, yeah.
For me.
Yeah, I do want to talk a little bit about the third act. So I loved the reveal that David Thewlis was Ares. Like, I love that scene where it's revealed that it's him. Because A, it was very unexpected. I did not see that coming. And B, I fucking love David Thewlis.
I'm all aboard the David Thewlis train.
Yeah, big fan of David Thewlis, and the reveal that he was going to be the villain, like, because I had no idea, and realizing that he was the villain of the movie, I was like, oh my god, oh my god. I was like having a little freak out. I was like, David Thewlis, the villain, oh my god, this is very exciting. But then it kind of devolved into this very generic CGI fight where CGI throws other CGI, and it's dark, and it's like visually kind of uninteresting, and it just didn't do much for me. I also don't think Ares should have been killed at the end, if that makes sense. I feel like that kind of muddles the point of the movie a little bit, which is that, you know, humanity is capable of these things by themselves. You know, it's not...
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's... introducing Ares as if he's a real thing makes it seem like it's entirely his influence that it's... humanity is causing all these wars. But now that Ares is dead, like, you know, World War II still happens, right?
we still got 80 years of war left in that same century. Like, we got a lot of stuff to cover.
Exactly. So that doesn't make a ton of sense. I think it would have been more interesting if he and Wonder Woman were foes over multiple movies, you know, because we would have gotten more David Thewlis.
Right.
And, you know, he's a dynamic actor who could have, like, that could have been a really great, like, adversarial kind of thing about him, like, popping up and being like, oh, Ares is over here, and he's about to start some shit in Russia or something. That could have been, like, very cool, like, modern-day Wonder Woman movie or something, you know?
Yeah, I thought that was really, really cool that I agree that the reveal that it was David Thewlis, because, like you said, David Thewlis is my dude. I thought that having Ares be... You know, he's the god of war tradition. You know, he is the god of war. Having him be this kind of like web weaver in the backgrounds, whispering the formula for mustard gas, right?
Yes.
Like into the Dr. Poison's ears.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah, like that version of that, like, kind of insidious war and hatred, I thought was a much more, was a very interesting take on that. And then, like you said, it, I, like, he devolves into, we're gonna superhero punch this supervillain who's gonna supervillain punch the superhero for 15 minutes. But I think that it, you're right. It could have been a kind of Moriarty Sherlock Holmes relationship where he's working in the shadows to influence humanity. And I think that could have been a more dynamic and interesting relationship for them to have. But that said, I get the kind of hopeful generic superhero impetus to have him die. And then, Chief is going to hug the German on the air, on the tarmac. So I get why they do that, right? But I think it's not as interesting. And that's that, I guess. I kind of lost my train of thought for a second.
Fair enough. I did want to say there are also, I think, a couple of, like, very odd editing choices throughout. There's just, like, stuff. Like, every once in a while there was a bit that was, like, jarring to me. But most off, and this was, like, very weird, I thought. During that reveal where David Thewlis, like, reveals himself as Ares, and it's this crazy thing, you know, Wonder Woman sees Thewlis, realizes he's Ares, and then realizes she doesn't have her sword. And then it's like, oh no, what's she going to do now? She doesn't have the sword that will, that's the only thing that can kill Ares. It's all the way on the top of the roof. Like, how is she going to get that in time? And then it cuts away to Chris Pine doing something. And then it cuts back to Wonder Woman having just retrieved her sword and returning to conversation with Ares, which, you know, it was nice of him to wait for her. But
yeah, how sweet. Yeah, I did notice that it's like it's her landing after jumping off the roof, and it's like, well, yeah, sure.
Yeah, like it almost leaves you on like a little cliffhanger thing. Where it's like, how's she gonna get her sword back before Ares attacks her? And then it cuts away, and then she cuts back, and she has her sword, and it's like, oh,
yeah,
all right.
how did you feel about having the two climactic battles happening in the same spot at in different parts of the same runway?
It was fine. Again, I feel like a lot of that third act is just kind of devolved into a kind of generic set piece for me. So not much of it really landed, but I did like, you know, the way that Chris Pine sacrificed himself at the end. That was fairly effective, even if it is a little derivative of Captain America's sacrifice in Captain America's First Avenger.
Right.
To the point where it's an actor named Chris playing a white guy named Steve who sacrificed himself in an airplane during a major
end
world
of World War.
Yeah.
I think that the sacrifice in Wonder Woman feels more.
Yeah. Well, he actually dies. More in Wonder Woman. Like, supposedly he actually dies in Wonder Woman.
That's true.
Presumably,
yeah.
Like, we gotta, like, you know,
yeah,
it's kind of
it is a super.
So, you know, we didn't actually see his body explode. So, like, who knows?
Yeah, who knows what happened?
Who knows what happened?
He parachuted to France, probably.
Yeah. In 2 years we'll get the Winter Pine.
Oh my god. It'll be the evergreen.
Oh god, that was the stupidest joke.
That was the Spider-Man 2 of jokes, Mike. But I did think that there was a really cool moment, just visually, when Ares is, when it's revealed that he's him, and then whatever, something explodes. I don't know. I can't remember. There's a lot of explosions at the end there. When he kind of, like, walks out of the fire and, like, pulls the molten metal into his armor. I thought that was really cool and was, like, interesting and unique in a supervillain kind of way. And then we don't go anywhere with that. It was just a cool design choice, I guess, for Ares. And then we turn into Doomsday Fight Part 2.
Yeah, which is kind of what it turns into. And yeah, I mean, I don't think we needed a romantic angle for Diana and Steve. I just felt like that was kind of tacked on. But then again, I don't think most superhero movies need that.
Yeah, so exactly.
It's kind of just following the lead from the entire genre.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of was, I don't know, I'm of two minds of it. I felt like it was, it is a very human story, right? In a weird way, like,
sure.
That it's Diana's first glimpse of love in her moment of coming out of, you know, out of Themyscira into the real, quote unquote, real world. And I don't know why I did quotes on that. It is the real world. And she's finally having human experiences. And I think love is one of them, in that, you know, that the Amazons, we are told, are Well, I guess they actually know. We're told that they were sent for to bring love to mankind, right? In that kind of like storybook moment, which I thought was really cool in the beginning when. Yeah.
It's the opening to a Disney princess movie, basically.
Yeah. But horrific, and it reminded me a lot of season one opening credits of The Leftovers, or the Sistine Chapel, because it's that kind of weird painted art style.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was sort of willing to forgive that also, that kind of human love story, though it is derivative and not that unique, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't like bug me that much. It just felt like unnecessary. But I also feel like they, like, that dynamic worked really well as like two friends who really respect each other.
As foils.
Yeah, gain respect each other over time, and so I feel like that was more interesting than just having them hook up halfway through the movie, you know. So there was that, and I did want to once again shout out the stuff on Themyscira, because it's probably the movie at its most fun. Just badass women being badasses, especially Robin Wright. Shout out to Robin Wright, and also Connie Nielsen, who plays Wonder Woman's mom. But Robin Wright, man, she is like just badass. She's not even in that much of the movie, right? She's in like probably like 20 minutes at most, because her character dies pretty early on. But even in that short time frame, like, her death is felt, like, it's effective, even though it happens, you know, pretty early on in the movie. And, like, she is just so dynamic and so cool. And, like, Robin Wright has always been a great actress. And I feel like in recent years she's gotten a lot more attention because she's been on House of Cards and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I feel like this really gives her the chance to be the badass that she has always been. So that's like, pretty cool.
Yeah. I did see another image going around online. I can't remember. There was three characters included, and I can't remember. But it was, you know, the sentiment was that I think it said I've lived long enough to see my childhood princesses become generals.
Right.
And it was Robin Wright as Buttercup, and then Robin Wright as Antiope.
Right.
And then Princess Leia versus General Organa in Force Awakens.
Right.
And there was one more, and I can't remember who it is, I think. But either way, it's badass. We're living in a kind of cool future, even though sometimes things are bad.
That could be the slogan for this podcast. What did you think of the other villains, the non-David Thewlis villains? Danny Houston and Elena Anaya as the German general, and Dr. Poison, which is a great name.
I couldn't help but think of Boardwalk Empire, which is, I guess, tragic. with the half a face thing.
The one face Richard Harrow thing.
The mask.
Yeah.
And I think Dr. Poison and I can't remember the crazy German name he has.
Yeah, Danny Houston.
Danny Houston. Yeah, they are at the same time, they are forgettably generic supervillains, right. And on the other hand, they are just like so diabolically cheesy, sinister that like I kind of loved them.
Yeah, they're like really like one note evil kind of thing. I kind of enjoy that about them. They are very thinly drawn. They do get one great evil scene where they lock up a bunch of people in one room with the evil gas that will kill them. And then they leave them one gas mask, even though they know that's not going to do anything.
Yeah, and they like giggle and run away. It's the best thing ever.
It's like, it's like they were playing like Ding Dong Ditch or something.
But like they kind of do that literally. but I did think that they were a good enough, I guess, human villain, where the other villain is like the literal god of war. Like that's Diana's villain, and Steve Trevor and his crew's villain is the Dr. Poison and Danny Houston. I think because of that they serve as the sort of, you know, I guess like we said, that David Thewlis is it's a reveal, it's a twist that he's the real villain.
Yeah.
So I was going to say they kind of serve as the kind of foreground villains that aren't that really important. But for the, you know, major hour and half or whatever, the last two acts of the movie, they are the villains for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
So I guess I defeated my own point. That I was going to make, fine. That I feel like that they don't serve a big enough role for it to matter a whole lot, but maybe on second thought they do, and they should have been more fleshed out.
that's Wonder Woman. I did want to talk a little bit about how you think this is going to affect the DC universe going forward. You know, they got Justice League coming out this year in November, which will have Wonder Woman in it. And I assume they're going to, like, my guess is that they any extra footage of Wonder Woman that they have, they're going to throw into that movie. Like,
yeah.
Because this is the first one that people liked. You know, it's pretty nuts. And there are, like, people who will very staunchly defend Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, Suicide Squad. These people are insane. And so...
Or crazy humans.
This is the first one that, like, mainstream audiences have really embraced. And I think that's really cool. And, like, critics have embraced it and everything like that. So I think Justice League will have... if it didn't already have a heavy Wonder Woman presence, which I'm sure it probably did, I feel like it's gonna go even heavier, which it could only be a good thing, I think, at this point.
I hope that they use this, the critical and consumer, that's not the right word, audience response, there we go, the critical and audience response to the positivity and the message of hope and, you know, the affirmation of mankind and humanity. Despite its flaws, I hope they take that cue and bring that to Justice League and the DC movies going forward. I think they have the opportunity with Wonder Woman, you know, in the kind of cheesy bookends for rediscovering her love, right? Or remembering, I think the note she says is, "Thank you for bringing him back to me."
Right.
That she sends back to Bruce Wayne when she gets the picture of all of them. And I hope that I think that's the cheesy voiceover is saying that you know, I don't remember the exact lines, but something about hope and love are what we need.
Yeah.
And I hope they you know, they have the perfect opportunity to have Wonder Woman be the one that brings that to the Snyderverse, to Justice League, right?
Yeah.
And I think it is interesting too, just, you know, I saw someone mention, I can't remember who, online about the Marvel movies originally, you know, everyone, like we mentioned, is chasing the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And Iron Man and Thor and those first few movies were primarily important good character stories, right? Good character movies about these characters. And Wonder Woman finally did that in the DC Universe.
Yes.
Man of Steel, not so much. Batman vs. Superman didn't even try, I don't think.
Batman vs. Superman really tried to rush into being, you know, Avengers 2 or something.
Right, exactly. So I think this is a good step for the DC movies and makes me hopeful going forward.
Yeah,
which is something didn't think I would say.
Yeah, hopefully it's not like an aberration and they took all the wrong messages from it or something. And
it's
the Ares movie is the next one they greenlight or something. Like,
it's just 85 minutes of Diana and Superman just being shot by machine guns. Like, they took the total wrong message.
But yeah, I mean, I think this does make me hopeful for the DC Universe in the future. And we've talked about, like, some of the stuff that's been happening with DC in the news. Like, they've hired a bunch of really interesting people to do some of their upcoming movies. Like, they've got Zack Snyder doing Justice League, and now Joss Whedon is on board to help with that movie, kind of shepherd that into the finishing stages. But then you have Matt Reeves attached to Batman, and you've got Joss Whedon attached to do Batgirl, which is insane. And then I think there was something else. I mean, James Wan is doing Aquaman, of course, which that's cool.
That's wild.
I don't think we'll ever see that Flash movie, but you know, we'll see. I think the priorities have really shifted, actually. Like, you know, when they first announced it, they're like, "We're going to do Flash, we're going to do Cyborg, we're going to do Green Lantern Corps." And I think you know, now it seems like their priorities are kind of shifting towards stuff that is more attainable.
Right.
I might say, you know, now they got Wonder Woman, and they got now they have Joss Whedon doing Batgirl. I feel like that's going to be happening soon.
I hope so.
Like,
I meant the soon part.
Oh yeah, well, that's what they since they have him, I would say it would go. I mean, I imagine he's busy with Justice League now, and then it would probably go into production in 2018 and be out by hopefully 2019. That would be my guess. But then, you know, you've got all the other stuff. James Wan's Aquaman coming out next year, and like so much that I feel like they're shifting their priorities. I don't think we'll ever see like a Cyborg movie, for example. I don't think that'll ever happen.
I don't know why we wouldn't have.
So I feel like a lot of the movies that they have previously announced probably won't end up happening. And there's a whole different kind of slate of DC movies that have been reworked over the past few months to kind of take their place. And I think Wonder Woman is going to be the first example of what those movies can be. And so hopefully that's the case.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Yeah. Years from now. So I think that wraps up our thoughts on Wonder Woman. Mike, do you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think we said it pretty well. This is a very important pivotal moment in movies and superhero, the golden age of superhero movies. Despite its flaws, Wonder Woman is really good. It's a lot of fun. And I think it's the movie we need right now. It might not be the one we deserve, but it's the one we need.
Fair enough. Yeah, I also really enjoy Wonder Woman. It's a very solid time. I think anybody who likes superheroes will like it, and it's a really important movie. So there's that. Definitely go see Wonder Woman if you can. You probably already have seen it, I would imagine, because everybody else has. Now, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, you can find me at crookedscoreboard.com. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast your email about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast towards the end of the month. I'm not sure exactly when it'll be, but the episode will almost definitely be Edgar Wright's Baby Driver.
Yeah.
So that's fucking awesome.
It's happening.
This is probably my most anticipated movie of the year, so I'm pretty excited about that. And it comes out the day after my birthday.
You made it just for you.
Exactly. That's how it feels, Mike. That's how it feels right here in my heart. So that's very exciting. We'll definitely be talking about that. And then check out our next Complete Works, where we are going to be talking Nicolas Cage's role in Ridley Scott's 2003 film Matchstick Men. Pretty stoked for that one, Mike. So thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.